cliffcentral.com.
The Threaded Man. Seems like a cool guy. I like him. I mean, he's got strong opinions. I love people's strong opinions. I love people who, you know, he seems like unusually confident for someone of his age. He seriously has like a, he's got a vision. He's got a, I like his attitude.
Yeah, he doesn't seem to like feel that failure is ever going to sway him.
Mm-mm.
Just part of the process.
Yeah, and he's a happy guy. He's like, he's got some plans, you know?
I still can't believe he's only 23, because, you know, most 23-year-olds are stupid.
Well, if I,
they're just doing dumb stuff.
Do you remember how you were at 23?
Yes, that's how I can confidently say that you're doing dumb stuff.
So basically, Sia and Miss Universe are two 23-year-olds who are exceptions to that rule.
There we go. And he definitely wants to sort out Babes Wadumo, hey?
Yeah, that would be interesting to watch.
He feels they're destroying her. Wow. All right. Now, somebody who we love to have on the show here, because he's always got an interesting take on things, and he teaches me things, and he teaches the rest of us things. He's a mentalist, Gilan Gork. We've seen him performing these incredible feats at his shows. He's been on this show before. We've done predictions. You know, Mubs, we've seen him figure out from all kinds of body language what people really mean. He is able to help you understand the way that humans communicate in subtle ways that we don't always do verbally, you know. And you've said to me, and I remember it very well, that only a tiny percentage of what we take in about another person is the actual words they use.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. 60 to 80% of what we communicate face to face is through nonverbal channels. And some research even suggests more than that, but at least 60 to 80%.
You see, yeah. So we're focused on the wrong stuff. I mean, if you're spending 60 to 80% of your time writing words in order to make a speech to people, you're missing the whole point.
Exactly.
Because most of those people have already decided what they think of you based on your body language or the way you look or whether you're looking at them in the eye or whether you're moving your hands in a certain way, right?
Yeah.
See, I find that fascinating. And I mean, I was watching it a lot with kind of what goes on with political leaders and Hollywood actors and those sort of people.
Yeah. I mean, actors and politicians, often they're what we call trained liars. You know, people who have to, anyone who has to stand up for their profession, so perhaps lawyers as well, you never know. People who have to stand up and say something that may or may not be an alternative fact or a version of the truth.
Damn right.
You know,
alternate fact.
So
like the earth is definitely round, but there's an alternate fact that it might also be square. It's impossible. Right, so let's just talk. I mean, it's always good to see you, Gilan, but let's catch up on where we were last time. Because you came in and we did a range of different videos and body language and a bunch of other stuff. And I've noticed you've been doing a lot of traveling. Like last year, you were all over the world. How many countries did you say you went to?
Last year was 11 countries from Asia and around Africa, Europe.
And this is for work. This is not holidays.
Yeah. It's amazing. Since my book launched, it's found legs all over the place. And
well done on the book.
Thank you.
It's awesome.
We're in our second print run now, and it's, you know, obviously also with online and Amazon and Kindle. It's just spread all over the place.
So people all over the world were booking you to come and do talks for them and teach them your stuff.
That's right. So, and a lot of it was word of mouth as well. I'd be at one event, some part of the world, and there would be some people there who were from another part of the world, and they would come up after and say, "Oh, we have to get you there." And it's about, you hear that a lot, but then when they actually make the call and organize, you know, the trips and the tours, I had this amazing tour to Asia. I was in Hong Kong, Philippines.
Wow.
You know, Singapore.
Very different body language and very different ways of communicating there, right?
Yes, I had some interesting conversations with some differences. And then you got the universal body language as well, which is what we're hardwired to do. You know, that there's the research done with children who were born blind, deaf, and dumb, and they found that they still use the right body language gestures and expressions linked to the right emotions at the right time, even though they couldn't learn it by observing it in other people. So we also hardwired.
How is that even, I mean, is that in the genes? Is it instinctive?
Yeah, it's hardwired into us. That, I mean, obviously there's certain, I mean, the source of body language, you have what's hardwired into us, and then you also have what is developed through culture and society. And that's often where you'll see some parts of the world that have certain gestures. Like in India, for example, there's a gesture where your head moves from side to side, right? Yeah. You don't get that in the Western world. And so it's a whole new gesture, basically. But you can learn it from culture and society. But we're hardwired as well.
And obviously, in an increasingly global community, we're borrowing a lot more from each other.
Yes, I think
so. We're all learning to communicate in better ways. It doesn't necessarily just involve language.
Yes, definitely. And wherever I travel, there are people who have seen videos of, you know, people in other countries, or they've studied abroad and so on. So a lot more sort of a global feel to people. They really, the world is becoming a much smaller place.
Well, I'm very pleased that that you're doing so much of this stuff internationally too, because I think a lot of people in South Africa know who you are, but a lot of people in the rest of the world probably want to know who you are, but they don't even know what this mentalism thing is.
I know, right?
Yeah.
That's why online is absolutely fantastic. And what you guys are doing here, you can reach so many people being on an online platform.
And it's fun.
Yeah.
And you're having fun doing it, because I know this is something that it is you. It's part of your basic integrity that this is how you are. And I want to know where it all started. Because I remember we've never really discussed you in these discussions. We've always discussed it, or the practice of it, or the people and how it happens, but never you. It's like, what kind of a family did you have growing up? Was this sort of stuff encouraged when you were a kid? What's your mom like? What's your dad like? Tell me about those things.
Well, I must say that I give a lot of credit to my parents for, you know, who I am today and what I am as in terms of a mentalist and a man and
sure.
so on. My mother is a qualified teacher. And principal, and my father is a chartered accountant. And about 40 years ago, they started a company called Educational Toy Center. Yeah. And they basically specialize in supplying schools and in early childhood development, which is from birth to about 6 years old.
The most important time.
Exactly.
When your brain is still soft and you're taking in everything.
Yeah. You know, people, a lot of emphasis is put on, you know, children with say tertiary education and so on in this country, especially because those children at that age, they can protest and they can make a noise. But what about the really young kids who, you know, them and their moms and the township, they don't really have that kind of voice, but it's the most important time. And so I was really fortunate that when I was younger, I would play with the toys that would develop things like, you know, social development, perceptual development, and all kinds of stuff that I believe has really helped me to become a mentalist and to do what I do. So
it's like you were an experiment, like your parents were selling this stuff, but you were actually being tested first. They're like, let's test it out on Gillan, and if he seems to respond appropriately and positively, then we can farm this out to other people in other schools.
I mean, I'm the youngest of four children, you know, and so I always had my siblings to play with, and so we could always use this stuff. But
that's important too, because when you're the youngest of four, there's a lot of competition for mom and dad's attention. There's a lot of competition for resources and stuff. And I'm not saying that you all had to fight for it, but you learn to read your elder brothers and sisters, and you learn to read your parents so that you can also get a piece of the action. Otherwise, you'll be, you know, forgotten at the back of the queue.
I think probably most of my having to read my siblings was for me to stay out of danger, because, you know, when you're the youngest of four, as everyone gets older, the age gaps change. So at one point, the eldest, my sister Leora, she was the cool one and no one else, you know, was really that close. And then suddenly my brother and my elder sister, because it goes girl, boy, girl, boy. My father calls that precision grinding. But so, you know, obviously as you grow, suddenly different alliances form, because the age gaps are just different at different ages and between girls and boys. And so there was always this changing dynamics. And so I just had to stay out of danger, I suppose, being the youngest one. But
so you could read them as well.
I could read them. In fact, I was the kid, you know, that they would know. I would walk into the room and say, oh, I want to show you something. I want to try something on you. Because from a young age, I was always involved in trying to...
So where did you first hear about the stuff that you do now as part of your daily life?
Well, mentalism, you don't really hear
there's no guide, as a child, right? There's no one walking around selling pots and pans, saying to people in, you know, in houses around South Africa, would you like to be a mentalist? You don't see the ads online.
Yeah.
There was no online when you were a kid.
Remember those aptitude tests, you know, and there was no mentalist in there. So.
Yeah, they say to you, do you want to be a doctor, a lawyer, a teacher, an accountant? That's it. You choose one of those.
Yeah. I think the questions were quite leading as well with those things. Yeah. It's like, what are, you would kind of choose your career in advance and then just tick the boxes that you thought would.
Exactly.
An accountant, yes, I'm good with numbers. But as a mentalist, I guess you just, it's like anything in life. You meet the right people at the right time. You happen to be the right person. Mm-hmm. And I met some mentalists when I was a teenager and was blown away by them. They were from, you know, international guys. And I just knew this was a calling. It just pulled me into it. And I did my first show when I was a kid, when I was 12 years old. It was my first paid gig.
That's meant to be.
So it was just, it's always been a passion of mine.
How do you even learn to do this stuff?
Mostly through mentorship.
Mentorship. But it's constant observation and practice, I would imagine, and focus. Because you're a very focused guy. I mean, Mubs, when Gillan talks to you, it's like he's zeroing in on you. You almost feel like you're being micro-observed. And I know that this is not the impression you want to give every time, but you got these bright eyes and you just kind of stare right into someone's soul and they feel like they have to be honest with you.
I get that.
Yeah.
I get that a lot. And I'm not sure if it's a good thing. Is it? Well, I don't know. People say, why are you looking at me like that?
I think it's quite engaging, but a lot of people might find it intimidating.
I suppose maybe the same way as someone might find the opposite disengaging, if that's the right word.
I would much rather sit and talk to you because you're very in the moment. You're very focused. You're very good at communicating and articulating your point of view on things. And also, you want to hear everybody else's, which is a real skill. You give the impression that you're interested in people.
Well, that's, you don't need to be a mentalist and mind reader to learn about people and read their minds. You just have to listen. There's a lot, you know, if you ask the right questions. I mean, you know this. You're excellent at interviewing people. You know that the right questions and reading between the lines of how people answer and not just what they say, but also how they say it.
Yeah.
And you know when you're interviewing someone, you can tell. And, you know, you come down, you ask the question, you know, it's a lot of focus and how do you practice it? At the end of the day, it has a lot to do with intuition, but I don't mean that in an airy-fairy kind of way.
Yeah.
Intuition is developed through experience and a feedback loop. So you know that if you are in a similar situation again and again and again, and you're talking to someone or you're playing a certain game or there's a type of interaction, you know that as you do it again and again, you're going to pick up little nuances and become better at subconsciously reading the situation. So, for example, firefighters who would walk into a room that's burning and next minute the chief firefighter says, everyone get out. And as they leave, the place collapses. And you say, well, how did you know to tell everyone to get out? You say, I don't know. I just had that feeling, right? Because we've got two different speeds of thinking in our brain.
Yeah.
We've got fast and slow thinking.
Okay.
Intuition is when our fast thinking can detect something before our slow thinking can even put a name to it. And that's what intuition is. And we can all develop that just through experience. And the same applies with body language and mentalism and anything in life.
Well, you mentioned earlier that the opposite of the way you approach people is to be disengaged. And you said that could also throw people. Now, I think it must be one of the hardest things to try and communicate, and I've attempted this once or twice before, with someone who is not paying attention. They're not in the room. They're physically present, but they're not there. They're always looking away. They never look you in the eye. They don't seem to want to connect at all. Those people are very, very difficult to deal with. So I think it would be way better every time if people were more aware of, you know, at least showing an attempt at, like, I do want to have a discussion with you. Because there's so many people who, and maybe it's because of insecurity. Maybe it's because they weren't socialized properly as a kid. Whatever the reason is, it makes it very difficult for those people to get ahead in life because everybody else goes, well, why should I connect with them? They're very disengaged.
Yeah.
They're not the kind of person you get any value from in return. You know, conversation has to go both ways, right? Mm. You have to give, but you also have to listen. Now, when you started picking up that you had a skill in reading people and being able to trust your own intuitions, how do you improve that skill? Because, I mean, your book wasn't available to people at the time you started doing this.
Sure. But a lot of resources, especially in the form of mentorship. And, you know, it's not something that one would publicize. There's no real school for mentors.
Yeah, like, but who did you have? Professor Dumbledore?
Yeah. You'll be surprised, Gareth, how many people come up to me after a show. Yeah.
Swami Prabhupada, who did you learn from? Who are these people?
There are some amazing, amazing thinkers. And similar to the singing industry, you get a lot of songwriters who perhaps don't enjoy performing.
Yeah.
There are some amazing, amazing mentalists around the world. You are these brilliant
thinkers. Do they
live thinkers.
Under trees and have long white beards?
Yeah, you would almost think so. And in fact, some of them do, I suppose. The more artistic ones. And they are just some amazing, amazing minds. And I've been so fortunate to mix in those circles. And I suppose also when you get to a certain level and you can contribute back into that and form relationships with people where you're sharing a lot of ideas and where you've got the kind of momentum, you know, for example, the number of shows and the number of talks that I do and teaching and mixing with people gives me a lot of information that I can share back into the mentalist community around the world. And so we exchange a lot of information.
So you do exchange ideas. It's not like if you have some idea that's all yours, you're going to keep it to yourself. That doesn't
help. Did anyone accomplish anything great with anything doing that?
No, that's exactly right. Exactly right. And that's also why I don't think we should involve the lawyers in too much of our lives. Because the lawyers try to protect and keep and control and confine. Whereas, you know, the best way to grow a great idea is to share it.
Exactly. There's a great analogy which one of my mentors from overseas, in 2011, I went to the States to do a leadership certification. John Maxwell, who is an amazing leadership guru, I think he's been voted 6 or 7 times consecutively as Leadership Guru of the Year. He says, in life, you need to be a river and not a reservoir. And so many of us, we are a reservoir. We learn things, we encounter experiences and people, information every day, and we just let it all swell up in our own life. And you need to be a river, right? We need to let that just flow right through us into
stagnant,
other people.
Stagnant water gathers disease, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah,
so
exactly.
If you're moving, if you're flowing, there's constant life and rejuvenation going on there.
Yeah.
All right, enough philosophy from you and me. I know that there are ways to pick up from people's behavior, from the way that they articulate themselves, both physically and verbally, whether or not they're honest people. So I'm going to ask you a couple of people's names. We've been watching them in the news lately. If you look at Donald Trump, he's the biggest story in the world right now. This is a guy who nobody thought would win. I mean, you might have predicted it because you have these powers. But he's the greatest branding self-marketing machine I think we've ever seen in action.
Yeah.
Do you agree with that?
He has done obviously something right. Jesus. You know, and people are scratching their heads and trying to work it out.
I'm scratching my head. I don't think anybody in the world except Donald Trump could have foreseen this outcome.
And it's not the first time that we said it. I mean, when Brexit happened, we kind of, it's the same sort of thing. We all sat there scratching our heads, right?
But this guy he's very studied about the way he projects himself, whether that's, again, intuitive, whether he's just doing things because he was raised a certain way or because that's what he was taught when he was a kid, or whether he's someone who is hell-bent on making it so, and he applies rules to his life that keep that communication straightforward and simple. Which is it?
Yeah. Well, and you nailed it on the head. It is. It's that straightforward and simpleness which is so persuasive and it's so powerful. You know, we spoke just now, I mentioned fast and slow thinking. And we have, there's a term called cognitive ease and cognitive strain. And so if something is very easy for your mind to absorb, we would say that is cognitive ease, right? A very easy way to think of this is if you're driving on the highway and you see a big billboard and there's a very big, clear word there, you would look at it and in an instant you get it, right? Cognitive ease. Whereas if it was written, if it's a whole paragraph, it's written in a really weird font, difficult colors.
Stephen Hawking. you know, try and explain the universe.
Exactly.
Major cognitive stress.
You would have to wait. You have to stop. And so you got that cognitive strain. And that's what kicks your slow thinking, your more analytical thinking into action. Now, the way that Donald Trump communicates is just very simple, very direct. And the kind of language he uses, the kind of gestures that he uses is just so easy. You absorb it. It's cognitive ease, right? The whole way through.
Let's talk about the hand gestures and let's talk about those tiny little hands. What is he doing with his hands? I noticed that his inauguration, he was doing a lot of gesturing.
Yeah. Well, he's got his signature gestures.
Yeah.
For example, he's got the pinch, right?
Yes, very tremendous pinch.
Exactly, the way his thumb and forefinger come together.
What does that mean to us?
Well, what that indicates is precision and control. And you'll often find that he will communicate precision and control, and then he'll do things like a hand chop, right? He'll use these very strong movements, impactful movements, which will also show that he's ready to action on what he's talking about.
Oh, he's a man who does things.
Yeah.
He'll just say things.
And the open palms, you know. This is interesting because I'm going to link a few things that we've spoken about now at the beginning of this conversation. Yeah. With the 60 to 80% of what we communicate being nonverbal, in my talks that I do when I teach people about body language in business, there's an experiment that I try where I say the exact same thing in the exact same way, but I change one element of my body language. And in fact, I'll release this as a video and we can repost it where I actually demonstrate this for people.
All
but
right.
Essentially what I do is I say something with my palms facing down to the audience, and then I say the exact same thing in exactly the same way, but then I just say it with my palms facing up. Now, when my palm is facing down, people always consistently feel more like they're receiving orders.
Huh.
Whereas when your palm is up, this is what we call a submissive gesture.
Is this because we're apes? Is this how apes use their hands?
Well, we find, of course, a lot of studies of body language is done in the animal kingdom, especially primates. Yeah.
Because if you, I would imagine if you're in a troop of chimps, for example, the hands tell you what the next action's going to be.
And when you're fighting for survival, you need to be able to read
immediately
other animals, you know, especially strange animals that come into your territory. Now, you got to see, are they aggressive? You know, so there's a lot of...
It's kind of a vulnerability about the open palm thing, right?
Exactly. In much the same way as if you had to say, you know, I promise it wasn't me. You're gonna say, I promise it wasn't me, or you're gonna say, I promise it wasn't me, right? And so, what I'm doing, just for those who are listening, is in the first one, I'm putting my hands up as if I'm, you know,
like you being someone's about to
like
shoot
someone's
you.
About to shoot me, right? My hands up besides, and the second time is almost as if I'm saying, come give me a hug, right?
Right.
Is that arms out, palms up? And the similarity here is that my palms are being revealed. You know, we're hardwired that if we're gonna be open and honest with you. With someone, we're going to reveal our palms. And if you find a lot of the time with Donald Trump, he's often revealing his palms. You know, he's using a lot of gestures where his palm is being revealed. And what that communicates is saying, hey, you can trust me. I'm being open, honest. I'm saying what I mean.
But can we?
I know, right? So and that, you know, and we're always looking for congruence. And so a lot of people are saying, wow, you know, is what he's saying non-verbally matching what he's saying verbally and what I believe his intentions are. So,
and what about our president? He is not very at ease in a public speaking environment. I mean, he's very good when he's speaking off the cuff. When he's relaxed, he's charming and he's warm and he's effusive and all of that stuff. But his body language, he's kind of stiff.
Well, our body language really leaks what we're thinking and feeling. And so often, depending on how we're feeling about something, our body language will start to reveal that. So just the fact that there's that contrast already can tell you how he's feeling about what he needs to discuss or what's going on in his mind. And, you know, whether it's something that was given to him as a scripted speech or something that's coming authentically from him.
When it's natural, I think he's also far more animated.
Yeah. You know, so obviously there's power in being coming across naturally. And then the thing is that people don't realize what you're leaking when you're natural as well and not coached into something.
Yeah.
And lots of politicians around the world are actually coached.
Yeah.
So you've got to be coached well, though. Otherwise, you come across as being phony.
Right.
But yeah, I would say that, you know, it's more powerful when you come across as natural. But you also run the risk then, I suppose, especially if you're a politician, of giving away a lot of your true intentions.
Now, do you have to be really mentally agile to not give away the game? Because there's sometimes strategic imperatives. Like sometimes you have things you need to do, so you shouldn't give away everything. Can you tell whether someone is deliberately holding back or if they're being totally open?
You can. Look, it also depends on how much pressure someone is under. And it's an interesting thing. You know, with lies, lie detecting is not like the movies where you
inject someone, you hook them up to a machine, and then you can tell immediately if they're telling the truth or a lie.
Yeah, there's no such thing as a human lie detector. You know, that's the thing of Hollywood. But we can tell if someone is feeling psychologically uncomfortable with what they're saying. You know, Donald Trump, talking about deception, I mean, this is an interesting one as well. I mean, when he was on the, you remember the Billy Bush?
Yeah, on the bus.
Exactly, on the bus, the recording. And he then obviously came out with an apology video. And in fact, I'll post this on the blog as well, that you can see the apology video. And at the time, when he says, in fact, I've even wrote down the time over here, at about 12 seconds into that video, he says, "Everyone who knows me knows that these words don't reflect who I really am. I said it, I was wrong, and I apologize." And what he does as he's saying that, his shoulder just gives a little twitch.
Let me see this, actually. Let me just see this.
"I've never said I'm a perfect person, nor pretended to be someone that I'm not. I've said and done things I regret, and the words released today on this more than a decade-old video are one of them. Anyone who knows me knows these words don't reflect who I am."
There, do you see?
There's a little shoulder shrug.
Yeah. So, exactly. So,
what does that mean?
But now he does it so in his inauguration speech as well. When he says to everyone, it's close to the beginning, around 3 minutes in, and he says, "This moment is your moment. It belongs to you." And that little shrug comes up
what
again.
What he really
right?
means is it's got nothing to do with you. It's all about me.
Yeah.
And in this case, he means that is exactly the person I am.
So, you know, that, so exactly. So that could indicate.
Look for a little shoulder shrug.
Yeah. And it's just it's one shoulder, right? Yeah. It's just his one shoulder that just gives a little shrug like that. So there's little nuances that show that someone is so in that case, it could indicate a deception, or that he's uncomfortable, or he maybe is kind of questioning what he's emotionally, what he's saying. Very interesting little things like that.
Who have you observed that is a really powerful master of this body language thing? Who have you seen
there
in action and thought, wow, this person really knows what they're doing? Or maybe they're just naturally able to do it.
In terms of a mentalist or a politician?
Anybody. Maybe someone that we could all identify. Maybe observe a little closely. I'm putting you on the spot here because that's just occurred to me now.
Yeah. I would say that if you had to watch professional conference speakers, I mean the real good guys.
Yeah.
You know, you mentioned a little earlier, you said that everyone's so worried about the words that they say, right? And I mean, that's the lowest form of speaking awareness, so to speak.
Yes.
As you become a more aware communicator and an awareness around speaking, you start to concentrate on not just the words you say, but also how you say them. But then beyond that is what body language you're using to communicate that. And if you watch really fantastic coached speakers, and I would say President Obama, for example, is a really great orator. So you could watch politicians who are really great orators. Yeah. Or if you're at a conference, a business conference, and watch the keynote speaker, because every little move has been designed to just push either a point or an emotion. And so if you just want to watch someone speaking.
Can you teach people to do this?
I do. I do. Yeah. You know, people obviously know me from the entertainment side, but 70% of my business is in teaching people how to influence and persuade and read other people in ethical ways and positive ways, of course. So leadership and sales and marketing and all of that obviously falls under the banner of influence. So it can be taught. It's a skill that anyone can learn and start to practice.
What kind of things should we stop doing when we communicate with each other non-verbally? What kinds of things do you find a lot of South Africans do that puts us at a disadvantage when we're in negotiations, when we're in arguments, debates, situations where we're expected to, I suppose, lead?
There are so many. Where do we start?
Give me a few. Like what kind of body language things, like even start with greetings.
Well, you know, people don't realize that we form 90% of our opinion about someone in the first 4 minutes of meeting them. And it's far easier to create a good first impression than it is to try and change someone's impression afterwards. So we talk about things like handshakes. So handshakes actually communicate a sense of authority or superiority or inferiority. If you had to shake hands with someone, often someone who has their hand rotated more towards the top would be communicating a sense of superiority. Power. Exactly. Anyway, the basic rule of thumb, it can get quite intense with handshakes. You know, a lot of people try to do the double hander, they feel that's quite a warm handshake. There's rules around that, you know. But I would say that, yes, you're right. You need to be careful with the very first impressions that you make. I would say probably the biggest mistake that people make is to interpret any one gesture in isolation.
Yes.
This is such a fun, and you know, I know this, I teach it, and I'll still fall, I still have to remind myself, don't interpret that one gesture. You got to think of so many different things and look at two or three gestures that communicate the same message.
Do you think that that some people, it's a confidence thing, it's almost like a tribal thing, like you feel, you know, there's an inferior or superior position being communicated primarily, because we are hierarchical things. Yeah, we can't help it. We belong to a social order. Do you think that's a big part of it?
I think that there are a lot of sort of primal instincts, I suppose. There are a lot of things that we're hardwired, and that is why people who want to get out of mediocrity need to break free of those instincts. And so, yes, you know, obviously the thing is to understand that other people are running off those instincts, but to become a truly great persuader and influencer and leader, we need to rise above that. And so you'll find that the best influencers are not the ones that try and be hierarchical and, you know, position themselves over
you. It's the ones who bring everybody in, right? What about the thing you focus on the most from your point of view? Again, we're going to try and tap into your experience in here. If you want to figure out whether someone is being honest with you, what do you look at first?
There's so many things, I suppose. That's such an open question. It depends on the context of what's being discussed. You know, is it a conversation where I'm interrogating you and I'm saying, did you take the money? You know, is it that kind of situation? Or is it a situation where we're in a social environment and someone's telling a story and I'm thinking, oh, I don't know if I believe that quite as much. And the truth is that, you know, on average, we lie 10 to 15 times in a 10-minute conversation with a stranger. I mean, everything from that.
Why?
Much.
I mean, what are we lying about?
Well, how was your day? Oh, yeah, cool. Oh, yeah, being to that place. Yeah, it was cool. Like, I mean, those would be lies if it's not true, but often those are little throwaway lines. But then also we tend to sometimes exaggerate a little bit about things, or our opinions might not be right. So they're not malicious lies.
And a lot of it is just because you want to be liked.
Exactly. There's this.
You want people to be happy to see you rather than hate you.
Yeah. Everyone's trying to fit in.
Right. Except Ben. He doesn't care.
Not really.
I don't give a shit about fitting in. Look at him. Antisocial.
When you're giving, you know, these courses and teaching people about body language, is it across the board stuff, or do the different genders, do you apply different things depending on the gender that you're working with because of the differences in the way that men and women, you know, are received by the opposite sex?
There are obviously differences between men and women. And I mean, if we come back to Trump, something that was really interesting when he met with Theresa May, and you start looking at the interactions. You know, if you look at a lot of politicians, male politicians, when they interact with each other, you'll find that they'll do a lot of like touching each other on the back, and there's like, you know, there's a lot of like trying to alpha each other over each other.
Right.
In fact, there's a video, such an interesting video of Israeli and Palestinian leaders, Ehud Barak and Yasser Arafat, and they were involved in peace negotiations with Bill Clinton. And there's a clip thing. I'll post it as well, where they're going through a door. And what's really interesting is that Bill Clinton walks in first, because in the Western society, that's what you do. If you're kind of polite, usually you will kind of let someone in through the door first, right? Now, in Eastern culture, by letting someone through the door first, right, what you're basically saying is, hey, I'm in control here. You know, I've got the power, and I'm going to control this process, and I'm going to let you go through the door first. So you find the struggle between the two leaders not wanting to go through the door first. They want to be the – and in fact, it almost looks like a bit of a tussle. And eventually, the one's basically being pushed in. So anyway, that's with males. Now you come back to females. You look at Theresa May and Donald Trump, who are together, and you find that at one point they're walking in the White House and they actually walk hand in hand. And there's a moment where Donald Trump holds her hand for just a few seconds in what seems like an affectionate kind of – but then he lets go of it and gives her a little double tap on the hand, like a little – almost a patronizing double tap. And let's go. I'll post the clip so you can actually see this. So a lot of people say, oh, holding hands, that's so affectionate. No, it's actually a communication of authority and power. And so, but obviously he's going to treat her differently because she's female. He's not going to put his hand on her back and so on. So there is that immediately that difference.
Well,
but still
communicating with all the things he's already been accused of.
Yeah, exactly.
But there is like an old school male way of dealing with stuff. And there's a kind of new, a more nuanced, more gentle, more us than me approach to leadership now, right?
Yes.
So Donald Trump really, in some ways, and Vladimir Putin and even our president, they represent that old way of doing things, that alpha behavior.
Yeah. Look, everything has its place. And there's a you've got to use strategically these techniques, but sadly these techniques can be used for good or for bad. I always use the analogy of the surgeon's knife. All of these can be used for great good or for great evil. A surgeon's knife, it just depends on the person using that tool,
whether it's a murder tool or one of health.
Exactly.
Tell me about you and like relationships. That must be difficult to be around you, because you can't be deceived. I would imagine you are You're never really off, because this is part of who you are.
You'd be wrong to think that.
Really?
Yeah.
You can turn it off.
That is something that people say, oh, I'm scared. I'm nervous to have a conversation with you. But if you chat to any of my friends, you'll see that I'm actually a pretty normal guy. I can be deceived. I'm human as well.
Mabali and I can't believe you have friends.
Yeah, it took a long time, Gareth. Don't make me lose them in this interview, right? I am as normal, and I'm as susceptible to stuff as anyone.
No, surely not.
I've got a heightened sense of awareness, but I'm human, and so the minute something happens that throws me into fight or flight mode, and my limbic brain system kicks in.
That's the fast thinking you were talking about as well, right?
Your fight or flight mode, exactly. That's got to do with the limbic brain system. That's our real instinctive. So if something gives you a fright or whatever, immediately there's certain biological, physiological changes that happen. Your adrenal glands start pumping adrenaline. Your body is saying, either I'm going to hit or I'm going to run. So your immune system starts shutting down, because your body's thinking, well, I don't need to fight this cold if I'm going to be eaten by this lion, right? I need to fight this lion. And it actually, blood goes away from your brain into your things like your fists and your legs. And so when I'm in a situation where something happens, I need to obviously deal with the same responses, because I'm human, that anyone has to deal with. And so that can also open me up to be, susceptible to certain things.
Well, I still don't know. I mean, you said heightened awareness. That's key here. If you want to observe people, if you want to figure out some of the things that make them behave the way that they do, you really need to be super focused and super aware.
And it does take a lot of focus. So when I'm doing my shows or talks, any kind of demonstrations, I have to get into the zone and really tap into...
Is it almost meditative?
Well, I meditate every morning.
You do?
Which really helps to kind of...
Transcendental?
Well, it's more just a guided meditation and being aware of thoughts.
Right.
And to be able to almost look, just to be able to watch your thoughts, almost from a, just to be able to be aware of. Exactly.
Wow. When you look at people in crowds, there's a thing that kicks in there too, which is very behavioral and interesting to observe. Like people start carbon copying and mimicking each other's movements, right?
Yeah.
What is that usually an indicator of?
It's so interesting that you said that, and you'll only really appreciate this if you have to watch the video that we're recording over here, because you're talking about mirroring, which is something that I just did with you probably about 3 seconds before you said it. Were you aware at all that I was mirroring your hand movement, which is what it was in what we called the Eiffel, right? So people don't realize that that's what happens, is that we mirror people all the time without realizing it,
yeah.
Just as you said. And what and one does it naturally, but one can also do it purposefully as well to create a level of connection with someone, because people will see subconsciously a reflection of themselves in you.
Does this help on a date? Like if you go out with somebody and you want to figure out whether they're interested in you or not, can you see if they start mirroring you?
Yeah.
You know they're keen.
Yeah.
Is that true?
Yeah. I mean, on a date, I remember I once met an ex-girlfriend's father, yeah. And I was mirroring him the whole time. She said to me afterwards, because obviously she was exposed, she said, "You were mirroring my dad the whole time, weren't you?" I mean, she knew that I was just trying to create that rapport, you know?
And it worked.
And it worked. Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm no longer with her, but yeah, I mean.
He's like, "Oh, this Gillen is such a great guy."
Exactly.
So I would imagine that's a good strategy for someone like Trump, who's all about ego and, you know, you play to his idea of himself. I would imagine the best possible strategy for him is to go in and to sit there and to observe him really carefully and kind of without being obvious and you know, cynical about it, you have to mirror whatever he does.
So mirroring, ultimately what you want to do is you want to mirror someone and get rapport with them and then move it to a place where you now break that mirroring and you want to see if they start mirroring you.
Oh.
And that's when you know that you've got that rapport and you've got that level of influence with someone. But that's obviously becoming much more advanced.
But I like this because this is the strategy we're talking about. Mm. So when you observe these people, have you ever noticed gestures and behavior that you were unprepared for?
Ooh, that I was unprepared for.
Almost like that person doesn't know, but they could be dangerous.
Like wow, so like as if I'm having a conversation with someone and suddenly I think, ooh, like there's something beneath the surface here.
Yeah. Has that ever happened?
I would say that happens probably more often than one thinks, but in far more subtle ways and not like a big event. Like I'm thinking, shit, I better actually leave and run because this person's going to pull something out and,
yeah.
You know. All the time, though, there will be certain gestures that will surprise you. So I'll give a very, very simple and practical one as well that people can use,
okay.
Which is that our feet often point to where our mind wants to go, where our mind is thinking.
Really?
Yeah. So there's a really fun experiment that I actually do on stage with people where I read someone's mind. I explain to the audience what I'm looking for at the same time. And one of the indicators that I try and get people to use is their feet. But if you're in a social setting and someone seems like they're engaged with you in conversation and they turn to face you and their body is turned to face you, if you look down and their feet, especially their leading foot that they're still, waiter,
yeah,
that's pointing towards the door, then you might think, okay, this person is obviously they might want to leave or whatever the case. I need to re-engage them. So that's one way that you might be surprised. You know, where the conversations I have with someone, and then I look down, I'm like, oh wow, this person's actually not really enjoying this conversation at all. You know, I'll either say, oh, listen, nice to chat to catch up, and I'll leave.
That's awesome.
So yeah,
that's very cool. Are there any dead giveaways that will help people to figure out whether someone is maybe a bit of a sociopath, like? Those people who don't, like they're just not even in the world. they kind of they are in their own space. Their body language would indicate that they're very isolated. Those kind of people. Are there things you need to look out for there?
Look, I mean, we're all actually on that spectrum somewhere of psychopath, you know, which is an interesting study just in itself. But people who, you know, lack empathy and connection, you'll be surprised, though, at how good they are at faking it.
Sure.
And they actually become very good at manipulating in a very negative sense. So one needs to, and because they don't feel emotions much the same way that we would, things like empathy and so on, it can be very difficult to put them under pressure because that often we give away a lot of what we're thinking and feeling when we're under pressure, and so our body language starts leaking clues. So it's actually a lot more difficult to read these types of people than what one might think. They're very good liars. And because of that, you know, that difference in emotional state. And by the way, this can be a good thing as well. You know, a lot of surgeons sitting somewhere higher up on the psychopath kind of spectrum, and a lot of investors and a lot of people where there's a lot of emotion, a lot of stuff at stake, and they're absolutely able to control it. So they're not
then,
bad people.
Then it's useful to you.
Very useful. But yeah.
So you've written a whole bunch of notes here in front of you.
Oh, these were things like at certain times that I had recorded when Trump had said certain things and whatever. Yeah. So this was just in case I wanted to give a bit of extra information. Well, we've pretty much gone through everything.
But we're going to put up a video. You're going to take parts of this conversation and show us the video clips that are associated with what you were saying.
Yes.
Because I think it's nice for people to actually see it, not just to hear it.
Yeah.
Right. And what's on your agenda for 2017?
2017, hopefully will be a little bit more travel. I'm looking forward to going to Colombia in March. I'm presenting at the World Sales Forum there in Medellin and Bogota, which I'm now familiar with because of Narcos. But, you know, apparently it's not the same anymore.
Oh, all right.
So that's quite cool. I've got some trips to the UK planned. And then, you know, my theme for 2017 is just adding value. And so I am going to be putting a lot more focus this year in putting out just some really good value-adding stuff for free on my website and my blog. And so every week I'm going to be putting out stuff for people to learn and hopefully reach tons of people around the world.
The night that Ben was on ENCA not so long ago, you were on as well.
Mm.
And I kind of, what was the reason that they had you on?
It was the Pastor Doom.
Yes. The guy who was spraying the doom in his congregation's face, and you were explaining how gullible people are, how credulous we can be.
Yeah. You know, they called me up and said, come tell us how people can actually believe this stuff, that this guy can spray doom on you and then suddenly, you know, it's going to get rid of the devil, the evilness, and so on. And I said to them, well, sure, I'll come on and explain it, but how about I actually demonstrate and do something that seems prophetic? But obviously, I don't claim to have any prophetic, you know, superpowers. And see, it's just what people can see.
You made Jeremy Maggs guess a color or a shape or something.
I had him think of a picture.
Yes.
And then I had him draw a picture, and I had drawn
a cat or something.
Yes, that's right. That's right. And I'd been trying to plant these little seeds of influence throughout. And that was quite.
I didn't see the seeds of influence being planted. How did you do that?
It's very, very subtle in certain things. I mean, right from the beginning, certain things that I would do with my body language, with my words, you know, as I'm walking on set as well, things that I'll be saying to him. So it's quite a risky thing to actually do, and I get just as excited when it all turns out right.
And he's skeptical as hell, right?
Yes.
Well, afterwards, he gave me, like, Jeremy looked at me, and it's like he saw the tokolosh. He was so, like, shaken up by
it. Well, Iman Rapetti was, like, cackling like a mad old hag when she saw what you'd done.
Yeah, I know, because I was actually going to do it to her at first. And then last minute, they said, oh, no, do it to Jeremy. So I had to kind of pivot and quickly do something with you. Yeah.
Maybe, maybe she only saw how bad his drawing of the cat was.
Well, you know, I've clearly had no influence over that, but it was an interesting experiment.
Well, listen, it's always good to catch up with you, and I hope you're going to have an amazing year, and we can always find out more by going to your website.
Yes, you can go to my website. In fact, there's a new website that I have up, which is
Influence.
Yeah, it's influenceinstitute.com.
Nice.
And this is something that I've launched, which will really be the platform for putting out all my teaching and videos and blogs and really interesting articles that are going to help you to become a better influencer and to be able to read people. And that's really helpful in business and personal life. So people can subscribe there, and every week they'll get some pretty amazing content.
Well, it sounds absolutely amazing. I wish you all the best of luck, and it's very good to catch up again.
Great to see you.
Good to see you. Gilan Gork, everybody. All right, let's clear out of here. We've got some unnews, and then we will hand you over to all the rest of the shows today on the lineup. I see the good stuff is coming up. I see Laws of Life with Gary Hertzberg. It's going to be a busy day. So stick around. CliffCentral.com, keeping you company today and hopefully making your day really, really interesting or funny or exciting or all three. Okay. Ex-KGB general linked with creating the dossier around Donald Trump's alleged golden shower incident has been murdered. Russian authorities are, of course, denying this, but they aren't denying the golden shower. In fact, that has been filed in the Western Leverage file deep in the Kremlin. In other news, first it was Ghostbusters that they rebooted, now it's Ocean's 8. The trend of making iconic male movies into female blockbusters is set to continue. Do you want to hear some of the other titles that they're working on? A Few Good Men is going to become A Few Very Good Women. Fast and Furious is becoming Sweet and Sassy. Dirty Harry is going to be turned into Dirty Hillary. And The Terminator is going to be turned into The Girlinator. That's all true. That's all happening. In an unprecedented move, the Queen wants to revoke Andy Murray's knighthood and give it to Swiss tennis star Roger Federer instead. After watching the Australian Open final over the weekend, she realized that nothing Murray has achieved has come remotely close to Federer. So he deserves the title, even though he isn't British. Wait and see as it happens. All right, everybody, we'll see you tomorrow. CliffCentral.com.